Hello, everyone, and welcome to our pre-presentation podcast. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Craigle, who's an ENT physician in St. Cloud ENT and also works with CentraCare. First off, hello, Dr. Craigle. Thank you for joining me and welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. In October, we are going to be talking in Science of Medicine about ENT emergencies. And I wanted to touch base about a few of them and your take and trying to guide the conversation towards the stance of the primary care providers, perhaps pediatrics, urgent care, etc. The first question I wanted to get started with has not to do with ENT, but how do you work with CentraCare? Because you have your own office or you work with your own group, but what is your affiliation with CentraCare?
Right. So I have been on the medical staff for 33 years since I came here in 1992. At that time, I joined St. Cloud Ear, Nose, and Throat as a partner, and I have remained as a partner since then. Kind of got my first job at age 31, and it was my dream job. So, you know, when many of the other groups in surgical specialties were interested in joining or being, you know, sort of bought out by the health system, we kind of decided that we wanted to operate within the health system, but with our own clinic intact. And so we practice just a few blocks from St. Cloud Hospital. We also have outreach sites in Sauk Center, Alexandria, Little Falls, Staples. Mm-hmm. I believe those are current outreach sites. And but of course, when we're on call, I mean, I think some of what we're going to be talking about, it has to do with those advice calls that we get. We get many advice calls from, you know, Redwood Falls and from as far north as sort of CentraCare's experience goes. So when someone calls with questions, they're often similar questions. And so some of the things I've tried to prepare in this talk are going to be basically what are some quick answers, ways to work things up, ways to treat, and then ways to ensure that the correct follow-up gets followed.
Great. So with that introduction, first off, we are going to talk about pediatrics, adult, and both populations, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the way I would like to approach this, I think the most practical would be to pick a few of the most important ones and try to do the same Q&A for each one. So my first question then is, what is the most terrifying ENT emergency that somebody can come across either in a clinic, urgent care, or ER?
Probably airway issues. So anything from an airway foreign body to epiglottitis, superglottitis, whatever you want to call it, to a very, very large either retropharyngeal abscess, parapharyngeal abscess, or peritonsillar abscess. These are things that make most ER docs quake in their boots a bit because they know that the airway is not secure and is at great risk. And of course, whether it's a child who, of course, can collapse very quickly, or an adult, it only takes a little more time for sure. Respiratory collapse.
And we all non-ENT physicians or providers, I should say, are always like, we don't understand. It's like a circle within a circle within a circle. That's the anatomy. But we all remember the danger space in the retropharyngeal area. So is there a classic presentation that points towards an imminent airway obstruction in both adults and pediatrics?
Some of it depends on the presentation, of course. So for an infectious presentation, you're going to see, you know, drooling, you're going to see some stridor or some sort of respiratory difficulty. The patient looks very afraid. It's a presentation that is hard to forget if you've ever seen that presentation. But again, if it's a foreign body versus an infectious presentation, it will look a little bit different.
Okay. So epiglottitis, what is your clinical pearls for epiglottitis? What does it look like? What should be done right away? And how do they ask for your help?
So the interesting thing is that when I started practice many years ago, pediatric epiglottitis was the only form that we ever saw, and it was very, very scary. Kids came in very sick, drooling. You know, you could hear them, you know, breathing very hard, and everyone was afraid to instrument the airway at that point. So we would rush them to the operating room and hope that we could get an endotracheal tube in before we had to do a crash tracheotomy on those kids. Of course, the HIP vaccine pretty much eliminated pediatric epiglottitis, but then we began seeing many, many more adult epiglottitis episodes, which, because the airway is much larger, referable to the patient's size, it's not as imminent of an airway collapse. They come in with very sore throat that's progressive to the point of dysphagia, dysphonia, and odynophonia, where it's actually painful to even talk. And those folk look pretty sick when they come in. A lot of times folks will do the lateral airway x-ray to evaluate that thumb sign for epiglottitis. Some will go straight to a CT scan, but usually imaging is pretty quick in that workup.
And that's to call you right away, right? That's an immediate emergency to call ENT.
Typically, that's one where, especially if there's a significant respiratory distress, that's a call quick.
Okay. Let's move to the sides and the posterior aspects, right? Retropharyngeal abscess, lateral abscess. What are typical presentations?
So peritonsillar is going to be by far the most common presentation of any of those lateral pharyngeal abscesses. And it's going to come typically in the picture of someone with a severe sore throat. Maybe they are strep positive. Maybe they haven't had a strep positive. Maybe they've gotten some oral antibiotics already. And they come in with a little bit of a hot potato sounding voice, with clear edema and asymmetry of the posterior pharynx. The uvula is generally deviated considerably to the opposite side. Mm-hmm. And often you can't even see the tonsil on the affected side because there's so much peritonsillar edema, it actually covers over that area. So there you can get pitting edema of the palate on that side. Mm-hmm. And so asymmetry.
And would it be fair to say that, you know, there's surgical conditions in which there's no time for imaging, but this is a case in point that a CAT scan is a must to delineate what's going on exactly?
Quite often, if ENT is not available to do an on-site exam, then imaging is definitely the way to go, CT scan. And sometimes you'll find large abscess, sometimes you'll find small abscess, sometimes you find a peritonsillar phlegmon or cellulitis where there's no clearly defined abscess. But it's important to figure out which of those you've got.
Yeah, and I'm here to standing to say I had a peritonsillar phlegmon. And I felt great. I felt nothing. But every time I chewed, it's like I had an Oompa Loompa stabbing me in the neck. But I just ate through it. And the minute I got prednisone, within 20 minutes, that was mind-blowing. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of fun. So, all right. Now, you mentioned infection-related causes. What non-infection-related causes can cause obstruction, both of the airway, foreign object, of course, but anything else, especially on the posterior and lateral walls of the pharynx?
So basically, angioedema, of course, which is whether it's truly allergic, whether it's pharmacologically induced, that can cause generally more swelling of the tongue, but it can be posterior pharyngeal, not so much of the lateral pharyngeal obstructions. Cancer, of course, is the first thing, the non-infectious things that I would think about. And most of the time, it's fairly easy to at least get a strong suspicion that there's a neoplastic.
But can he have such an abrupt presentation, like an emergency kind of presentation?
Occasionally, someone with progressive dysphonia who is developing, say, a not so much of a pharyngeal, but a laryngeal, true vocal cord or supraglottic tumor, they can sometimes go long, long time. And then all of a sudden, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a little hematoma that forms, a little bleeding, a little sudden swelling, and suddenly an airway that had margin has none, and they're, you know, stridorous and presenting with respiratory distress and imminent failure.
Okay. I'll ask a question. I like to ask potentially stupid questions so nobody else has to ask them. And I always hide it by saying, well, I'll just do infectious disease. I remember from medical school, I may have heard that when you have a peritonsillar abscess, you could potentially drain it in the office with a needle, but you have to be careful that the patient doesn't have a carotid aneurysm. Can it present that way, or that's incredibly rare?
That's very rare. I've actually used that technique either with a large bore needle, 16 gauge needle, and a 3 or 5 cc syringe, or I've used actually an IND with an 11 blade. And I mean, I suppose in the back of your mind, you need to be aware of you know where you're at. Generally, you have to transgress the pharyngeal constrictor muscles behind the abscess before you get to the great vessels, whether they're normal great vessels or whether they're, you know, there's something abnormal there. So generally you'll get, even if you've numbed up the palate, you'll get a significant increase in pain when you hit those constrictor muscles with your needle or your 15 blade. But generally for non-ENTs, they would probably try to do a needle aspiration of it. So I wouldn't worry too much about the great vessels. Yeah, if you've got a standard length needle, if you're burying it more than halfway to the hilt, you've gone far enough, and you've done your best to try, and it's time to call me. And
you don't feel like all of them should be called to you. They can be attempted by people who
correct.
Know what they're doing.
ER docs are well trained in this. We're very happy with the way our ER docs here in St. Cloud and many other of the hospitals that we consult with are handling peritonsillars. They almost always are willing to take a shot at it. They know very, very clearly what the landmarks are and what the, you know, where the point of stopping, you know, stop trying is. Okay. So
now quickly, for the people who are not perhaps familiar with it, could you talk about what the danger space is and what that means and when that becomes a real problem, what it causes, and what's the timeline progression of an involvement of it?
I think you're referring to the vascular space sort of behind and lateral to the tonsils.
Yeah, like the space that communicates. I mean, you could track all the way to the mediastinum. I understand it.
So that's the midline. That's the retropharyngeal space. Mm-hmm. And there is a potential space that goes from the skull base. Mm-hmm. And it's just areolar tissue, really. It's like kind of a tissue-lined space. And that can go well down into the mediastinum. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Retropharyngeal abscesses have a small chance, if they get into that space, to track all the way into causing mediastinitis. The skull base is kind of an end point. I suppose you could get some sort of meningitis from that, but at least the big thing is the distal passage of pus into the mediastinum.
And we talked about peritonsillar abscesses, retropharyngeal. What's the difference in etiology, whether anatomical or by microorganism, or, you know, can you get a peritonsillar abscess tracking all the way around, or is a different story that starts right away in the retropharyngeal area?
So typically retropharyngeal abscesses would be a lymph node in the retropharyngeal space that then turns abscess formation, rather than a peritonsillar abscess, which starts in the back wall of the tonsil and generally tracks laterally into the peritonsillar space. And then from there can track even further laterally into the parapharyngeal space. So you can get extension of a peritonsillar abscess laterally into the parapharyngeal space. The retropharyngeal space is generally not a peritonsillar situation. It's a different, maybe the same oral bacteria, but it's probably going to be a different etiology. And it's a lymph node that probably has abscessed in that plane.
And interestingly enough, you could have a lymphadenitis without much pharyngeal correlation to it, right? It could be just a pure lymphadenitis, whether it's cervical, lateral, or posterior. Is that fair to say?
Correct. It's possible, though most of those folk will have pharyngeal symptoms, dysphagia, odynophagia, sore throat, that precedes the actual abscess formation of a retropharyngeal abscess.
Okay. And perhaps the last one I wanted to talk about is the one that in infectious disease you are taught is the only infectious disease emergency to go to the hospital. I say, well, call an ENT, because what am I going to do? Which is when you get more into the space of the sinuses, and especially in poorly controlled diabetics with DKA and fungal rhinosinusitis and potential expansion to the, you know, to the brain cavity or the septic thrombophlebitis, etc. Can we talk a little bit about that kind of presentation?
Yes, generally fairly debilitated folk, often, frankly, ICU patients can get either a primary fungal sinusitis or they can get an isolated, say, sphenoid bacterial sinusitis. And there is a significant mortality rate for those people. Now, again, it's not clear to me, at least, whether that's related to the population that this is occurring in. They're already debilitated. They already have sort of higher mortality rates for other reasons, and they may be in the ICU again with higher potential for mortality rates and all of the problems that they're having. But there does seem to be some increased pathology for both isolated sphenoid sinusitis. So that's something that we're draining that, doing a procedure to open up that sinus is useful. Fungal sinusitis tends not to have as much of a high mortality rate because it tends to be non-invasive fungal sinusitis. In an immunocompromised individual, HIV positive with poorly controlled disease, the fungal sinusitis can be very, very deadly because there's some really, really odd pathogens that can become, you know, suddenly like saprophytic pathogens that can just become suddenly very, very potent.
And of course, some signs include chemosis and proptosis and, you know, inability to move the eyes, and that's our very drastic presentations.
That is similar in kind to malignant otitis externa, which we will discuss at least a little bit in our presentation as well. And there you can get an osteomyelitis that is, it causes, in the case you're talking about, cranial nerve neuropathies that signal the severity of this in the depth of this infection.
Fantastic. So this is great. We'll be talking about different conditions and how they present. And of course, when we need you right away, when we need you in the morning, and when we can call and make an appointment to make the workflow work better. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.